Iraqi resistance groups joined the chorus of condemnation against the US attacks on Syria, saying Washington's crimes will not go unanswered. The EU foreign policy chief says a diplomatic window of opportunity to dialogue is open for reinvigorating the Iran nuclear deal. Also ahead, a UN expert calls for sanctioning Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and doing justice after a US report finds him responsible for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, Iran's foreign ministry has strongly condemned the US airstrikes in eastern Syria as a violation of human rights, international law, and Syria's territorial integrity. The ministry spokesman said the US strikes are in line with Israel's aggression against Syria and would increase instability and military encounters. Saeed Khatibzadeh said that the US's years-long presence in Syria is illegal and accused the United States of occupying Syrian soil and stealing its natural resources, including oil. Khatibzadeh said that the illegal U.S. bases in Syria are used for training terrorists. On Thursday, the U.S. launched overnight airstrikes on facilities belonging to anti-terror resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border. The attack was ordered by U.S. President Joe Biden. Syria has strongly condemned the move.
The Syrian Arab Republic condemns in the strongest terms the U.S. aggression against its sovereignty, which contradicts the terms of international law and the United Nations Charter, and with its role as a permanent member of the Security Council.
The Syrian Foreign Ministry warned that the U.S. aggression would lead to repercussions that escalate the situation in the region. Iraqi resistance movements also condemned the attacks. Iraq's Qatar Hezbollah group slammed the strikes as barbaric aggression. The Secretary General of the Badr organization, Hadi Al-Amri, called on the Iraqi government to investigate the U.S. strikes. Also in a statement, the Al-Nujaba Islamic resistance movement stressed that the U.S. attacks would not go unanswered. Political commentator Media Benjamin says the latest U.S. airstrikes on Syria are against President Joe Biden's campaign pledge to de-escalate conflicts in West Asia and withdraw troops from Iraq and Syria.
But what it says is, unfortunately, we don't see what he promised on during his campaign, which was to get the U.S. out of the wars in the Middle East, de-escalate, use diplomacy, re-enter the Iran nuclear deal. It's very unsettling because the excuse is that it's in response to the attack in Iraq on U.S. personnel. And there we have to question why are U.S. personnel still in Iraq after the parliament said that it wanted them to leave. It also begs the question of why are U.S. personnel in Syria to begin with? And then is this part of trying to strengthen the U.S. hand around negotiations with Iran? And some analysts say that that's what's behind this, but I would say it will elicit the exact opposite response, strengthening those inside Iran who say that they should not negotiate with the United States and in fact want to give up on the Iran nuclear deal. So we see this as very disturbing as peace activists in the United States. We're calling for the Biden administration to immediately stop the escalation of conflicts, to go back to its promises of getting the U.S. out of the Middle East and rejoining the Iran nuclear deal.
The European Union says there is a diplomatic window of opportunity to salvage the Iran nuclear deal.
We do have a diplomatic space, a diplomatic window of opportunity to dialogue at this moment and to reinvigorate this deal according with the wish explained and expressed by the new Biden administration. We need to use this opportunity and focus on solutions to bring the JCPOA back on track.
Joseph Borrell made the remarks in a news conference held via video link. The top EU diplomat supervising the international agreement said the chance to revive the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, must not be missed. Meanwhile, the US State Department said the Trump administration's so-called maximum pressure policy against Tehran has failed to achieve each and every single one of its aims. Former President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 and imposed sanctions on various sectors of the Iranian economy. Tehran has accused Washington of economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. Political commentator Keith Preston says that U.S. President Joe Biden seeks to escalate hostility with Iran.
I think that the Biden administration is very rapidly moving to close this particular window. This deal was put together, of course, as we know, back during the Obama administration, and then the Trump administration unilaterally abrogated the deal. And based on the performance of the Biden administration in these early weeks of Biden's presidency, it seems that Biden is actually continuing to a large degree many of the policies that were put into place by the Trump administration, which was ongoing escalation of hostilities with Iran. Just within the last 24 hours, we've seen that happen now with the American attacks, on Iranian or Iranian-allied targets in Iraq. And we've also seen that the Biden administration has, instead of moving to distance itself from Saudi Arabia or undo the relationship that was developed between Saudi Arabia and the Trump administration, we see that the Biden administration has announced that it's not going to take action against Saudi Arabia, even for its killing of an American journalist a few years ago, which was also something that the Trump administration refused to do. So to a large degree, so far, the Biden administration's policies towards Iran on many issues related to Iran seem to be largely more in line with the Trump administration.
The U.S. says sanctions against Saudi Arabia over the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi are concrete steps to recalibrate relations with the Arab Kingdom.
You've seen a number today of very concrete steps that are both looking at past conduct, but as importantly, looking to the future to prevent future conduct. I would say the relationship with Saudi Arabia is an important one. We have significant ongoing interests. We remain committed to the defense of the kingdom. And so what we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to recalibrate it.
Well, Andrew, I think the report speaks for itself. And I think
Washington's restrictions target members of the Saudi Royal Guard's Rapid Intervention Force, but not their patron and Commander Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the king's son. That's despite a CIA assessment that says bin Salman approved the murder and dismemberment of Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia's Istanbul consulate in 2018. The UN investigator on the murder case earlier called on the United States to sanction bin Salman, targeting his personal assets as well as international engagements. Agnes Callamard said the U.S. should not give the Saudi Crown Prince immunity from civil suits and ensure all information is fully declassified. Political commentator Ali Al-Ahmed says Washington has a policy of supporting the Saudi monarchy against human rights activists and promoters of democracy.
Well, the United States government is not a human rights organization, nor it is a charitable organization. It's a state, so it will use and deploy human rights depending on its usefulness for its policy. And so you can see the human rights status in the Gulf countries is directly linked to the fact that the U.S. government, and I was told personally by a senior member of the Obama administration, that we support the Saudi monarchy against you, against human rights activists and human and promoters of democracy. That has been the policy, and I don't see any change yet.
Also, political commentator Kevin Barrett says Mohammed bin Salman is a rogue impersonating a head of state who is a member of a family of bandits.
Now, we all knew what was in the report. That was leaked, but nobody saw the actual report until now. And yes, it's confirmed that indeed, as the Saudis say, a rogue operative was responsible. And that rogue is bin Salman himself. He's a rogue impersonating a head of state. He's just, you know, another typical member of that family. They've been bandits for centuries. They got their start stealing from people going on pilgrimage to Mecca, and they're still bandits and rogues. So the world sees this, and yet they're in control of the holy places. They've got control of more oil, or at least they're sitting on the oil. It's really the big banks and the Western banksters and corporations that control the oil through their Saudi puppets. But maybe it's time to change things. Maybe it's time for the people of the region to have more say. I don't have a whole lot of hope that the Biden administration is going to throw its weight behind a major rethink of U.S. policy in the region. I think they're going to hem and haw. There will be some people on one side, some people on the other side. And as usual, they will just continue muddling along as the American empire gradually collapses.
The United Nations and the European members of the Security Council urged the Israeli regime to stop demolitions in a Palestinian village in the occupied Jordan Valley. The European Council members expressed deep concern at the recent repeated demolitions and confiscation of items in Homs al-Baghia. They said the concern was also focused on the 70 people or so living in the Bedouin community, including 41 children. The EU countries also called on the regime to allow humanitarian access to the community. This was also echoed by the UN envoy for the region. Tor Wennesland urged Israel to cease the demolition and seizure of Palestinian property throughout the occupied West Bank. An Israeli cargo ship has been hit by an explosion while sailing through the Gulf of Oman. According to a maritime security group, the MV Helios Ray was struck overnight. A U.S. defense official said the blast hit the ship above the waterline that ripped holes on both sides of its hull. The crew members were not injured, but the stricken vessel was forced to turn back towards a port. The cause of the blast was not immediately clear. The vehicle carrier ship is owned by a Tel Aviv-based company. According to satellite tracking data, the vessel departed the Saudi port of Dammam on Wednesday. In 2019, several vessels were struck by explosions in the Gulf of Oman, including Saudi oil tankers, with nobody claiming responsibility. A sit-in has been staged in Rome in support of millions of Palestinians demanding Israel to comply with its international obligations and provide them with COVID vaccines. Max Chavidi has the details.
Rome's Association of Palestinians called a sit-in in the vicinity of the Italian parliament to draw attention on Israel's COVID-19 vaccine program, which excludes the nearly 5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip under Israeli military occupation. The rally was supported by a number of left-wing groups and unions.
The fourth Geneva Convention stipulates that Israel has a responsibility as an occupying power to ensure that medical aid reaches the occupied territories to combat the coronavirus crisis. Responsibilities also include providing vaccines in a non-discriminatory manner to Palestinians under its control.
Israel has the duty to provide COVID vaccines to Palestinians. The question is why nobody talks about it here in Italy. TVs and newspapers praise Israel's vaccination campaign, but they don't say a word about how Israel is a militarized country which is not observing its international obligations and pays each vaccine dose double the price, promising pharmaceutical companies patient data.
While Palestinians' right to health care is undermined, Tel Aviv has pledged to send thousands of spare coronavirus vaccines to foreign allies that have accepted Israeli sovereignty in Jerusalem, such Czech Republic, Hungary and Honduras.
These vaccine donations are the latest example of Israel's new expression of soft power. Tel Aviv rewards or sways those that have little access to vaccines in exchange for their complicity. This confirms the absence of morals and values of Israel.
We are calling on Italy, the EU and international community to take concrete measures to force Israel to provide Palestinians with vaccines. We are not begging, we demand what is ours.
In January, the United Nations voiced its concern over Israel's refusal to vaccinate the Palestinians, but the appeal has gone unheard so far. Max Civili, Rome.
Over 2 dozen people are killed following a riot in a prison in the suburbs of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. Local sources confirmed that 25 people, including 6 prisoners, died in the violent breakout. The prison's director and one of the country's most powerful gang leaders were among those killed. Over 400 prisoners also managed to escape. The incident is one of the largest and deadliest prison breaks in Haiti over the past decades. The prison in question has a maximum capacity of nearly 880 inmates, but nearly double that number were held there before the escape. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar has strongly condemned the use of lethal force by the country's military against anti-coup protesters.
I told you in 2019 that I would sound the alarm if necessary. This is now the case. I'm ringing the alarm bells. I strongly condemn the recent steps taken by the military and urge all of you to collectively send a clear signal in support of democracy in Myanmar.
In her address to the UN General Assembly, Srinina Bergener called on the world body to use any means necessary against Myanmar's military to ensure people's safety. She said no country should recognize or legitimize the junta. On Friday, police fired stun grenades, rubber bullets, and guns into the air to disperse protesters in Myanmar's 2 biggest cities. Several people were injured. Myanmar has been rocked by deadly protests since the military seized power in a coup on February the 1st. The military has cracked down on the protests, arresting demonstrators and ordering internet blackouts. At least 3 protesters and 1 policeman have been killed in violence at the rallies. European Union leaders have agreed on more responsible and coordinated efforts for the security of the 27-nation bloc. The bloc leaders in a virtual summit insisted that Brussels needs to bolster partnership with NATO and the United States. In a tweet, European Council President Charles Michel said the EU wants to act more strategically to enhance collaboration with allies and defend its interests. Attending the summit, NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg also emphasized the need for cooperation between Brussels and the Western military alliance. The French President Emmanuel Macron also addressed the summit, stressing that Europe needs to anticipate the new form of cyber, maritime, space and air threats. The EU is seeking to implement a multi-billion-dollar fund for its defense projects. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
According to a United Nations World Food Programme WF report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Robin Scher, writer. This article is published under the heading, Pandemic May Have Left 265 Million People with Acute Food Shortages in 2020. Here's more. According to a United Nations World Food Programme report, COVID-19 might have left up to 265 million people with acute food shortages in 2020. The combined effect of the pandemic as well as the emerging global recession could, without large-scale coordinated action, disrupt the functioning of food systems, which would result in consequences for health and nutrition of a severity and a scale unseen for more than half a century, states another UN report. In the United States, food insecurity has doubled overall and tripled among households with children due to the pandemic, states a June 2020 report by the Institute for Policy Research, IPR, at Northwestern University, which relied on data provided by the U.S. Census Bureau's Household Pulse Survey. In a recent interview with CBS News, IPR Director Dionne Whitmore warned that these statistics would likely continue to hold, with the numbers indicating particularly dramatic rises in food insecurity among Black and Latino families. Indeed, families of color are being disproportionately impacted. According to an analysis of new census data by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, 22% of Black and 21% of Latino respondents reported not having enough to eat, compared to just 9% with white people. Globally, the effects of COVID-19 on food security are equally, if not more, severe. According to a CBS News report, WFP Director David Beasley told the UN Security Council in April 2020 that the world is on the brink of a hunger pandemic. He added, in a worst-case scenario, we could be looking at famine in about 36 countries. And in fact, in 10 of these countries, we already have more than 1 million people per country who are on the verge of starvation. The number of chronically hungry people increased by an estimated 130 million last year to more than 800 million, about eight times the total number of COVID-19 cases to date, wrote Mark Lowcock, the Under Secretary General and Emergency Relief Coordinator at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and Alex Van Trottenberg, Managing Director of Operations at the World Bank. Countries affected by conflict and climate change are particularly vulnerable to food insecurity. Empty stomachs can stunt whole generations. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, warns that climate change is likely to diminish continued progress on global food security through production disruptions that lead to local availability limitations and price increases, interrupted transport conduits, and diminished food safety. The same might be said about the pandemic, which has made it abundantly clear. Climate resilience, food security, and global health are closely intertwined. In terms of food security, another major concern is the pandemic-related school closures that have occurred across the globe, with UNICEF reporting that more than 1.6 billion children and young people have been affected. Schools provide a food lifeline for children. For so many, that is where they get their only nutritious meal of the day. In January, UNICEF and WFP released a new report that found that more than 39 billion in school meals have been missed worldwide since the pandemic began, with 370 million children worldwide having missed 40% of in-school meals. In early 2020, when COVID-19 was still a looming specter rather than the deadly virus we are more familiar with today, the threat of food insecurity was a practical problem. Scenes of shoppers descending on aisles to stock up on supplies was a common sight. As CNN reported in March 2020, supermarkets around the world rationed food and other products such as toilet paper and cleaning supplies in an effort to curb stockpiling. In Vermont, for instance, a steady increase in food insecurity since the start of the pandemic has correlated to employment levels, according to a survey conducted by the University of Vermont between March and April 2020. Approximately 45% of respondents had either lost their jobs, been furloughed, or had their hours reduced during the pandemic. And a further two-thirds of survey participants who recorded scarcity of food in their households had experienced job losses or work disruptions since the outbreak of the pandemic, according to the survey. Vermont is just one example. The impact has been felt across the U.S. during the week before Thanksgiving last year. The Guardian reported that 5.6 million U.S. households struggled to put enough food on the table. While referring to the analysis of the census data by CBPP, as the pandemic continues to upend lives across the world, it has impacted the entire food supply chain. With factory and supermarket workers being highly susceptible to COVID-19, there has been a commitment decline in food production and a rise in prices. As Scott Faber, Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at Environmental Working Group, EWG, reported, farmers across the U.S. were already facing labor shortages prior to the pandemic, and with tightened immigration as well as the heightened risk and poor compensation associated with these jobs, food processors and farm labor contractors may struggle to find other workers willing to risk their lives to work in meat plants, packing sheds, or produce fields. The pandemic has exposed the weakness of the industrialized global food system, which depends on long, complex transportation chains and cross-border travel. The monstrous and unsustainable food industry known as Big Ag relies on the horrendous treatment of laborers, a wasteful allocation of resources, worldwide environmental devastation, and in a pinch, can quickly devolve into near collapse of the entire system, as evidenced by the delays, shortages, and pressure during the COVID-19 pandemic and the deepening hunger crisis in America. April M. Short, a fellow at the Independent Media Institute, recently wrote in Salon, "Among the many necessary systematic changes, 2020 has illuminated the need to majorly restructure the way we cultivate and access food in our communities." It didn't take the pandemic to reveal the inefficiency and injustice of the food system. Globally, a third of all food is wasted, while nearly 690 million people were undernourished in 2019, almost 60 million more people than in 2014. But the pandemic has underscored matter According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the number of acutely food insecure people could increase to 270 million due to COVID-19, representing an 82% increase compared to the number of acutely food insecure people pre-COVID-19. And the disruption of transportation has shown that the long distances it normally takes for food to get from one place to another can be a serious liability during a crisis. Food banks are under tremendous pressure to meet the skyrocketing demand, wrote Claire Bainbow Fonaut, Feeding America CEO, and Zippy Duval, president of the American Farm Bureau, to then Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue in April of last year. At the same time, however, we are seeing literally tons of agricultural goods being discarded because of the shutdown of so much of the economy. Consumer demand has shifted from eating out at restaurants and food services away from home, and food supply chain operations have had to be retooled. And that impact has been felt within the transportation sector. Forbes reported that Andrew Novowick, an agricultural economist at Cornell University, points to a number of weak spots in the food transportation system that could be aggravated by the increased demand for food. A shortage of truck drivers is one potential weak spot, says Novavik. Although he concedes there is debate on this matter, he maintains that trucking companies are finding it much harder to recruit those long-haul drivers. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, an intergovernmental economic group with 37 member countries, said that the pandemic has laid bare pre-existing gaps in social protection systems in a report published in June 2020. While the impacts of COVID-19 are still unfolding, experience so far shows the importance of an open and predictable international trade environment to ensure food can move to where it is needed, the OECD report states. The biggest risk for food security is not with food availability, but with consumers' access to food. Safety nets are essential to avoid an increase in hunger and food insecurity. Another problem is the lack of media coverage about the food insecurity being witnessed around the world, particularly during the COVID-19 era. As the Economist recently pointed out, journalists in 2020 wrote more than 50,000 articles about the cancelled Eurovision contest, but only around 2,000 about drought and hunger in Zambia.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody, and here are some interesting points to ponder upon as elucidated by the leader of the pious, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. The whole good is gathered in three characters: consideration, silence, and warning. Every consideration that lacks learning lessons is inattention. Every silence that lacks thinking is inadvertence. And every warning that lacks the mention of God is nonsense. Blessed are those whose consideration teaches them lessons, whose silence causes them to think, whose wording is mention of God, who weep for their sins and save people from their evil.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojiza kardid, millat Iran, millat mojiza asay qarn ast.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini. God bless his great soul, and I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. Once again, I have Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, academic, scholar. Welcome to the program, sir, on your contribution and insight on Imam Khomeini.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much.
Brother, we've been talking a couple of sessions now on the theme of polarization, a very important theme and something that carried on from, you know, the days of the revolution into the imposed war. That's when Saddam, backed by, you know,
his everyone,
yeah, almost everyone. And it comes back to that theme of polarization, exactly, of course, because, you know, Iran was completely alone, I mean, in that war.
Except Syria, yes.
You know, everybody backed Saddam to, you know, basically overthrow the revolution. And, of course, you know, Imam Khomeini, with this great personality from the teachings of the Holy Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them all, you know, is fighting this war exactly like the way Imam Ali alayhi salam fought his wars, and that is uncompromising. You know, justice needs to be done.
Yes,
because, you know,
We all know. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Exactly. No, please.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We all know, you know, greatest soldier ever, Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Exactly.
Greatest military person.
Exactly.
I'm talking about not, you know, you see people are like, oh, what does that mean, you know, today? I'm talking about personality, military personality.
Yes.
Obviously, with the given technology and the circumstances of the era.
Mm.
But, you know, somebody who the mere mentioning of his name, you know, makes the enemy flee.
Flee, right. Exactly.
So.
Or tremble with fear.
Tremble with fear. And literally, you know, wet their pants.
Exactly.
Which we have several cases of that happening.
Of course. Literally happened.
Literally happened.
Yes,
that's what I'm saying.
Well, that's true.
It's not a.
No, we're not making it.
We're not making it. One of the names for Imam Ali alayhi salam is Haydar al-Karrar.
Exactly.
Karrar is literally means the one who keeps attacking and attacking.
And that would be exactly
which is the opposite of Farrar, which is somebody who flees.
Exactly. And we have on record who fleed where. They fleed.
Yeah, well, let's not go there.
Let's not go there.
Right.
But the main thing is that as far as Imam Khomeini, God bless his soul, because he comes right out of the teachings of the
Ahlul Bayt. He's not scared
and
of
course,
war.
And, of course, his great love for Imam Ali
definitely
is there. And we see that in his personality, that he's the one who keeps saying, no, the war will not stop until our demands are met.
And until Saddam, the initiator
of this
war, the one
war,
who killed innocent people, the one
is
who
punished,
transgressed against every Islamic international custom and law and everything that everybody knows in this world was his fault and all the crimes that he committed until he is punished. It's not simply about, you know, driving him out of the Iranian territory any longer.
It's about punishing him.
It's somebody who is a criminal has to be punished.
Exactly.
For the damage they have done to other innocent human beings. Okay?
And Imam Khomeini
now,
is uncompromising
now,
in that.
Now, imagine saying this and you have a lot of people around you being like, well, no, this
well,
is...
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And of course this is going to repel people. Of course this is going to make some people feel like, you know, why? Let's just kick him out of the country, whatever. Okay? Which was what which is what they were talking about. Okay?
Yeah, sure.
So, the point is that you have this unjust, unfair, imposed war. And it's not just Saddam. It's like it was like Saddam attack. Well, Saddam was the instrument with which all these nations united
attacked.
to kill the Islamic revolution.
Yes, and this was unprecedented because, as you and I know at the time, you know, the Soviet Union,
and the Americans
were at first, you know, they had common ground all of a sudden.
Right. They had the same language.
They had the same language.
Just like Israel and
Saudi
Arabia
have the same language
now.
They had the same language at the time to get rid of Imam Khomeini out of Iran. So
not only Imam, to get rid of the Islamic Revolution. Because all their batil, all their unjust and evil schemes and plans and profits that they were making and domination that they had, especially in this strategically important area of the Middle East, West Asia, was being threatened. Okay? So, the point is that that's when you see this hardcore personality coming through. Okay? You have a hardcore personality like him. You have this personality who is not simply trying to, you know, compromise with an evil criminal, you know, mind in terms of, you know, or an actor like Saddam or his supporters or the Zionists or whoever it is. Even though a lot of people are saying, you know what, let's just, you know, there was that famous thing during the war, a lot of people who know the history of the war, where you had the president who was then, you know, who then fled in wearing women's clothes, Fani Saad. He basically said, we have to have a strategy where we give territory and we win time. Which, you know, militarily is just...
It's ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
Yes.
Because the whole point is territory.
Yes.
The point is to get back territory in quick, in a lot, in the shortest time.
Shortest possible time.
Right. So a complete, you know, whatever you want to call it, you know, amateur when it comes to military affairs. And, you know, whatever. So Imam at that time is completely standing against that person who, and then, you know, that was the conflict that they got into because he was saying, oh, I have the people's votes and... you don't need to tell me what to do. I know what to do, blah, blah, blah. In the end, Imam's like, you know what? You're not worthy of the presidency. And the parliament, you know, impeached
him.
Right. And he then, he went into the arms of the Munafiqeen, of the terrorist cult around, you know, those, that,
so
that lady and
really
that gentleman.
So he was exposed for what he was.
And in the end, he ended up shaving his ridiculous little mustache. Putting on women's clothing and fleeing to Paris. So this is the deal. And basically what you see is that you basically see that Imam from the very beginning of the war is taking a very hardcore strategic view of this. He's not only looking at the daily battles and, you know, this kind of short term, well, let's see what we can do here, then let's see what happens afterwards. He knows from the very beginning how this thing is going to have to end up. Strategically, historically. Okay? So, forget about those things that are happening internally. You have insurgency being started in
Kurdistan
by Saddam. This is before
the war actually started.
It's actually 2 years before that, where you have Sheikh Chamran going in and the local people joining together with the Revolutionary Guard and, you know, defeating the Saddam-backed Kurdish terrorists. You have the military coups that are being attempted in Iran. The Nojeh coup, where you have former officers being paid by the Americans to, you know, conduct a coup. You have you know, disturbances in different parts of the country.
Of course.
So there's a million things going on.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have the war. And here's an 80-year-old man, and he's managing it.
Yes, he's managing it.
Right?
This is what you call faith and trust in God.
Right. And he's managing it not in the sense of, you know,
yeah, yeah.
Saddam, well, you I know, will, if you don't do this, I'll chop your head off.
No, no. I mean, it's not like he's got detailed plans and charts all in front of him. He's a man who's...
He's managing it based on certain principles.
Principles.
Because he knows that these principles, which are from God...
God.
...will get you the result.
The result.
The most important being that you, as a leader, are not scared, do not have fear. Fear. You don't... You trust Allah's, you know, power. Over everything else. And you don't consider yourself anything.
Exactly.
In the face of God.
Exactly.
And he has that famous line, I will never forget that line, where, you know, the soldiers are there in Jamaran, you know those films, which
yes,
is
yes.
like just amazing. Mm. You know, the soldiers are coming to see him before they go to the front
sure.
in Jamaran.
Yes.
And he's holding a speech. Mm. And you know those Imam
yeah.
speeches.
It's fine.
It's
yes.
like, yeah. And he says to them, he says, you're not my soldiers. Because I think they were chanting something, oh, we are your soldiers, or something like that.
No, he said, you're not,
he said,
my,
you're not my soldiers, soldiers and I'm not your soldier. Soldiers. We are all God's soldiers.
Soldiers. And you do not belong to your parents, you belong to the Imam.
Okay, so this is the things that... This is the kind of leadership you require in these times, okay?
Yes.
There's many examples.
Mm.
You know, they attack... There's problems. He gets rid of them because remember, the president is the commander in chief.
Chief.
So he gets rid of the commander in chief. He says, you're no good for this.
No.
Okay?
Yeah.
He insists on the Revolutionary Guards being established
sure.
as a revolutionary military force.
Sure.
He insists on the besiege force being established. And he says, we need an army of 20 million.
That's right. Yes,
okay.
You reminded me. Yes,
he says, we
right.
need an army of
20 million. Yes, and there was that famous poster with one guy holding up that banner of La ilaha illa, and you have all these multitudes behind him.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, he doesn't dissolve the army.
No. He actually wants to...
Listen, this is a big move
yeah, yeah.
by Imam. It's,
yeah.
it's a super hardcore, you know,
yeah.
move.
Move.
Because all these left-wing, you know, munafiqeen, all these, you know, radical groups
they
are
want
saying,
to disband the
let's
army.
Get rid of the Shah's
army.
This is the
that.
Shah's army. Mm. We will be the army.
Yeah.
And Imam's like, no, these are good guys.
These are good guys.
These guys, it's not their fault.
No.
They were in the army. They were serving their nation. They were defending their country.
Country.
Honorable men.
Yeah.
Most of them religious in their private lives.
Sure.
You know. We have to keep them. Not only do we have to keep them, we honor them.
Honor them.
They themselves know what to do. They don't need American advisors.
Yes.
They know themselves what they have to do.
Yes.
They are better than the American advisors. They know how to defend their country better than foreigners.
Yes.
So he keeps the army. He establishes the Revolutionary Guard. He establishes
besiege.
He gets rid of the...
yeah.
He gets... I mean, that getting rid of Bani Sa'd was just brilliant.
Brilliant.
Know?
Yes, it was.
He's like, dude, you're out of here. Okay?
Yeah.
He's dealing with the coups. He's dealing with insurrections. Okay.
Yeah. And the other fact that, of course, you know, right at the outset as well, that many of those who masterminded the revolution as well, who later on became the government, they were assassinated by those very...
Exactly. We had the big...
And the Americans were thinking, yeah, we're onto the big one here because...
Remember,
about 72
this is actually,
of them,
you reminded me
yeah.
of a very important
yeah.
episode.
Yeah.
All of this, we're telling these episodes and these... So people know the history.
Yeah.
So they understand the personality of this person. You know,
sure.
you have this thing of Imam and, you know, in the West especially, people don't know his real personality.
No.
So the first person that they kill after the revolution is who? Is Shahid Mutari.
Shahid Mutari, yes.
God bless his great soul.
So, yes.
Okay? The first person they kill is Shahid Mutari, who's one of the leaders, the clerical leaders, who's a smart person.
Yes.
There's a famous story where you have the leaders of the Munafiqeen cult coming to... see Imam.
Yes.
And they have a camera with them.
Mm.
And it's clear what they want is they want to take a picture with Imam and then go around the world saying, oh, Imam has given us the approval that he's with us.
Sure.
And Imam, since before the revolution, had declared them to be non-Muslims.
Yes.
And giving money to them is haram as
yes.
as homes because people had asked them.
Sure.
So they make it in front of the door of Imam's room with the camera. This is how far they are able to get.
Mm.
And Shahid Mutari happens to be there. And he says, what? You want to take this camera? no, Imam doesn't want you to take a picture. They're like, no, no, no. And you know the whole Iranian Eastern kind of off. And no, halal, okay, so it doesn't matter. So let us take it in. Blah, blah. You know what? You know what Shahid Motahhari does? He takes the camera and he smashes it. Fantastic. Right there. He says, I will not let you take a picture with Imam. You see? Another, you know, this is what you do for truth.
Truth.
They are trying to, you see, this is the way munafiq,
yeah,
and people who are hypocrites and people who don't really believe the truth but have to live with the fact that there are people who actually stand up for truth and that they can't just openly, they try to do it through, you know, indirect and sneaky ways.
The sneaky ways.
And then a person like Imam Ali alayhi salam, a person like Imam Khomeini, a person like Shahid Motahhari, when they stand up to them and actually break the camera, which is the tool for them to want to do their nifaq and want to do their, you know, propaganda, well, obviously they're going to cause enemies. And what do? They kill him.
Yes.
And what a great shahadat that is.
Yes.
To be killed by the enemies of truth.
Exactly.
Right? So, the first person they kill is Shahid Motahhari, and you have the funeral for Shahid Motahhari. This is 2 months after the revolution. I'm talking about the personality of Imam.
Yes.
Remember, didn't cry when his son was killed in Najaf.
No.
Everybody who was there in Najaf said Imam did not cry at the at the ceremonies for his son. Sorry. Didn't cry when he arrived. Didn't cry at the... Nothing. How do you feel? Nothing. He's crying at Shahid Motahhari's funeral.
That's right.
Okay?
Yes, I remember
the only person funeral that he cried at was Shahid Motahhari's.
Yes?
Why would he do that? Because he is a person who is embodiment of this polarization. He's the one that wrote the book about the polarization
of Imam Ali.
Right?
Yes.
I'm not saying this is the only reason. I'm saying Imam knows who Shahid Motahhari is.
That's why he
Imam knows, you know, who's been martyred. He's crying on the one hand because he's happy for him that he's martyred. And that he got to his goal. Right? And on the other hand, he's just thinking about, you know, this humanity. These are the people they kill. The way they kill our Mullah, the way they kill all the good ones.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
So Imam is crying at Shahid Motahhari's funeral. And the only other time he cried, that we saw him cry, was during Ashura and during Muharram.
That's right.
The ceremonies.
Yes.
Okay, we didn't see him cry anymore.
No.
And what does he say at Shahid Motahhari's funeral? This is important.
He said, this is my son.
Besides those things.
Yes.
You know what he said? He says, killing us is not going to stop the revolution.
Ah, yes. Excellent.
This revolution is dependent on nobody.
Nobody.
Even if I am killed,
yes, the revolution... Yes, even if I am killed...
Even if I am killed, the revolution
will not affect
continue.
The revolution.
And just a note for those gentlemen for who all these years insist that if they are not around, then the revolution will stray.
No, that's not the case.
Yes. Imam said, even if I'm not there,
there,
the revolution will continue.
Continue.
Because it's not about
personalities.
It's about Islam. It's about Haq.
Haq.
It's about people standing up for Haq, which the people have.
Yes.
Okay?
And there's always somebody else in the wings.
So, they're thinking, oh, we got one of the main dudes.
Yeah.
Then they go kill the 72.
The usual,
you know,
insane type thing.
They kill Shahid Beheshti and the 72 members of the Islamic Republican Party.
Party, yes.
Which is considered the elites and the top management of the revolution.
The masterminds of the revolution.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And thinking, well, that's it.
That's it.
It's
We've
all
done it.
Well, it's not.
No. They didn't do anything.
That's it. Right?
Yeah.
So, the point is... So we have all this stuff going on. We've got the war then going on, and he being a decisive commander.
Sure.
He's saying, for example, he's saying, this city has to be liberated. Right?
Yes.
This city, that city, this battle. And then Khorramshahr, which was the main city that the Iraqis had held for years, is liberated.
Yes.
Through the, you know, this ongoing struggle. The revolutionary forces, the Islamic forces, the Islamic Republican forces are able to, the Iranian forces are able to liberate Khorramshahr. And what does Imam say?
God liberated.
God liberated Khorramshahr. Right?
It's a totally different world.
Right?
Yep.
Doesn't mean that people didn't struggle.
No, no.
Doesn't mean that he's not...
But the victory is attributed to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Victory and defeat and everything is in God's hands.
Hands.
If you won, don't get arrogant.
Don't get arrogant.
If you won the victory, don't get arrogant.
This is a blessing from Allah.
When they were using chemical weapons, he forbade the use of chemical weapons against the Iraqis.
Yes.
People are saying, well, what does that mean? And, you know, we can respond in kind in Islam, and it's not a problem. And then he's like, nope.
No.
We will not use chemical. This nation, which is under the banner of Islam, will not use chemical weapons against other Muslims.
Because this is principle. This is truth.
Right.
Yeah. And the other thing that you were mentioning before we came on air was the fact that, you know, the Imam gave this very powerful command to sink an American ship.
Well, when the Americans entered the Persian Gulf, under the guise of protecting, you know,
the
shipping lanes.
Oil tankers, yeah.
The first thing he said is, you know, sink one of them.
Sink one of them.
And, well, they didn't for various reasons.
Yes.
And the justification for not doing it was, well, the Americans are going to enter the war.
Yeah. But they entered it
anyways. And then they entered it anyways.
Yeah.
So
if they had listened to the Imam.
So if they just listened to the Imam.
They wouldn't have entered the war.
I'm not saying the Americans wouldn't have entered it, but. Well, if they're going to enter it anyways, you might as well, you know, give them a little warning, a little deterrence, as they say.
A little deterrence.
You know, a little, you know, thought along the way if you want to get involved.
Well,
things are going to happen.
Mm.
And so this is the deal. When you have a hardcore person like Imam, who's not scared, it has to go back. It goes back to being not scared.
Scared.
And how is it that you're not scared? Again, for me, this is theoretical because I'm scared all the time.
Okay.
So what I'm saying, it's not that I'm not claiming that I have this mastered in some way.
Mm.
Why is Imam not scared? And remember his famous quote. He swears by, you know, the unity and oneness of Allah, that I have never been scared of anyone except for Allah. Remember, this is a big.
No, this is
big.
This is very important.
It's big.
That's just like our imams.
Right, it's big.
It's big.
It's not a small statement.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
And why isn't he scared? It's because he has complete trust in Allah.
Of course.
I mean, it
and
sounds
Allah
simple.
Allah will do things.
It sounds simple.
Which is beyond human imagination.
It sounds simple, right?
Yes, it does. But it's deep. Things happen, which we can't imagine.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, what would have been the consequences if you had actually sunk an American ship?
Well, I would argue minimum is the Americans would think twice.
Think twice, yes. Or would have let the Soviets deal with the problem.
Well, all I'm saying is that, you know, your action has an effect on things.
Of course they do.
Okay? So, let's say they had done that.
Yeah.
Maybe, I'm not saying, you know, things would have been greatly different.
Sure.
It's the principle of it.
Mm.
If you're going to enter our territory, if you're going to enter our area, you know, you're going to have to pay for it.
You're going to have to pay for it.
All right? If you want to, go ahead, but you're going to have to pay for it.
Exactly.
Okay? So this is the deal. Mm. This is what a real... You see, we have this thing in the West where it's... Defense is a necessary evil.
Yes.
This is the way they justify it in the West.
Yes, that's right.
Especially in the Christian traditions.
Yes.
They say it's a defending yourself militarily is not evil. No. It's good.
It's good.
It's not a necessary evil.
No.
It's good. It's just.
That's what you have to do. Naturally, that's
it's
what
just. It's the embodiment of justice. It's the embodiment of righteousness.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not a necessary evil to defend yourself.
Sure.
Yes, going to war, getting killed, killing, you know, maiming.
Yeah.
These are not pleasant things to do.
Sure.
And I don't mean pleasant in the if you're fighting, you know, against shaitan, it's actually quite pleasant.
It is.
Okay? It's not a, you know what I mean?
It's no, not it's
like
not a part-time hobby.
It's pleasant in the sense that you're doing a righteous act. It's like, you know, you're doing something good.
Yes.
So it shouldn't cause you trouble. And by the way, can I just add something? This came to my mind right now.
Please.
Notice that how in Iran we don't have the psychological problems among people who go to war as you have in all other countries.
Yes, that's a very good point. I mean,
soldiers don't commit suicide.
Suicide when they come back.
I'm not saying people aren't shell-shocked, some of them.
No, of course they do.
This
suffer.
Is a natural physical reaction to some
from
of the things.
The traumas
but we
of
don't
war.
Have that thing of, you know, veterans returning and becoming, you know, heroin addicts.
Yes,
we
and
don't
psychopaths.
Have, you know, the more amount of people, you know, Vietnam veterans killing themselves from suicide than actually died in Vietnam.
Malam,
you know, we don't have that stuff.
No.
Why? Because in our view, which is the view of Islam, which is the Islam of Ahlul Bayt, going to war is not a bad thing.
It's a good thing.
Especially if it's defending.
Yeah.
Of course, we have to also mention as the main point, which is that all these wars that the West is doing is, you know, unjust offensive attacks against innocent people.
Exactly.
So obviously the soldiers are going to get confused and want to kill themselves after they've killed innocent
people.
Exactly.
Okay?
They're human beings.
That's the consequences of killing innocent
people. You see, it's crazy. The whole military structure in the West tries to somehow create soldiers that will be immune to the effects of killing innocent people.
Yes.
This is the craziness they've reached.
Yes. But it doesn't work. It
doesn't work. You're dealing with human beings. There's a you know, you can't change human nature.
No, you can't.
Human nature, however you are, wherever you come from, whether it's Alabama or you know, whether it's Iran or wherever, you know, human nature is repulsed by killing innocent other human beings.
It is.
But it is not